From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. You're with James Freeman and the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 28th of March, 2023, and a very warm welcome to the Freeman Report this lunchtime with me, James Freeman. It's the lunchtime crunch time on the Freeman Report as I discuss the emerging issues that we all need to take action on. Now, today I will be discussing an explosive new report out soon that will lay bare the incompetence of the UK's drug regulator, the MHRA, and its failure to protect the public from dangerous new drugs. Now, I've read the report and it is truly shocking. Now, I want to know how we got to a place where our drugs regulator works for the pharmaceutical companies and not the general public. I mean, isn't the main job of a drug regulator to ensure that new drugs coming onto the market have been thoroughly tested to ensure that they're safe? And isn't it also the job of the regulator to monitor ongoing use of drugs with precision to check for safety signals that might indicate that a drug already on the market is causing harm? That's what I thought a drugs regulator is supposed to do. And if I asked members of the public, I'm certain they would think that is exactly what the MHRA is doing. Well, it turns out that this is not the case, because it seems that the MHRA has become an enabler for Big Pharma. And that's not me speaking. That is exactly what Dame June Rain, the head of the MHRA, said in a recent speech. She also said that the MHRA is a building full of policemen designed to hold things up. No, June, not to hold things up, but to ensure that Big Pharma doesn't harm the public in its race to make money. Now, what becoming an enabler means in practice is cutting corners in safety trials, for example, by focusing on dramatically cutting the time it takes to approve new drugs and allowing the very same corporations that stand to benefit from approval to conduct the safety trials. Yes, that's right. Big Pharma gets to mark its own homework. You see, the truth is, the whole regulatory structure in the UK has been designed with big business interests in mind. Yes, that's right, business interests. When in fact, the whole purpose of developing and distributing new drugs from the end point user's point of view is for health benefits, not making money. Now, there are many examples emerging of new drugs being pushed on millions of people when the real evidence suggests very little or no benefit at all. In fact, many drugs have been shown to do more harm than benefit recently, because all drugs have side effects. Statins are a good example of this. You see, as well as capturing the regulators, it seems Big Pharma has also captured universities and research institutions via huge grants in the tens and hundreds of millions. In the case of statins, it seems that the drug does indeed reduce cholesterol, but that the link between cholesterol and heart attacks and strokes is not what Big Pharma wants us to believe. They have spent millions pushing research that shows a strong link when it is now clear that this is not the case. Well, my first guest is a clinical psychologist who thinks that a similar thing is happening with the diagnosis of ADHD and the prescribing of powerful stimulant drugs that are far from proven to be safe and effective over the long term. In fact, he has been attacked for raising the alarm and speaking out about the flaws in the research. Now, a recent study in America suggests 9.4% of children are now being diagnosed with ADHD and given powerful stimulants. which is an alarming rise and contradicts other studies in other countries that suggest a baseline rate of about 3%. So, what is driving this increase in the number of children being diagnosed with ADHD? Is it because the condition is on the rise? Is it down to better diagnosis? Or is it big pharma doing its thing? You know, capturing research institutions, incentivizing doctors to diagnose and treat the condition, and attacking those who expose the truth. So to talk about this in a moment, I will be joined by Yakov Ofar. And to talk about the failures of the UK drug regulator, the MHRA, I will be joined by the amazing Claire Craig from Heart Group. Now, as you will have noticed, the TNT schedule has changed. So if you're not sure who is on when, you can find a complete list of all the shows and our schedule by simply visiting our website at tntradio.live. We serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and expert commentators who can separate fact from fiction and truth from propaganda. Right here on TNT Radio. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Stay updated on everything you need to know.
They keep me up to date.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
How you doing, Darren?
Oh, I'm very well, James. How are you, my friends? Apart from the weather, I've got to go out in a minute and hand some forms in to the local authority, and it's absolutely pissing down, as we say. So I'm going to get really, really wet in a minute.
Yeah, I did that thing where I left a load of washing on the line yesterday, didn't bring it in. So it's out there at the moment, blowing in the rain. I'm not going to get it. I'll just leave it out there. Your forms, is that to do with your... You standing in the election?
Yeah, these are the election forms. I've got my signatories for the ward that I'm intending to stand in. I'm actually discussing whether I actually stand in this ward now. I'm somebody who sticks to a plan once he's made it, and I've got a plan. But unfortunately, Nick Kelly, who is leader of the Plymouth Independence Alliance, unfortunately collapsed the other day. He had some sort of heart attack or a stroke. I'm not going to say what the cause is. Maybe it's because the MHRA approves certain medical products too quickly without doing safety examinations. And I wish Nick Kelly, as I'm bringing him up, all the best. I hope you recover. And if there is a certain medical product responsible, that's an if, not saying it is, then I hope that there's a lesson learned there. Very unfortunate. Yeah, go. Sorry.
Yeah, well, a bit of advice, Darren. The best operators are always adapt. They're flexible. They have a plan, but they're always prepared to adapt and change that plan. So, if the opportunity is changing, then yeah, definitely do that. Right, what story have we got today? I think it's the UK Health Group warns over fast track drug approval plans in the UK.
Yeah, very quickly, the MHRA, as you was just talking about, is intending to streamline clinical trial approvals and biggest overhaul of trial regulation in the UK in 20 years. The legislative changes will help to make the UK one of the best countries in the world to conduct clinical research for patients. New measures to be introduced by the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA, to make it faster to easier to gain approval and run clinical trials in the UK. It's claiming changes represent the... Yeah, I've just said that. According to the MHRA, clinical trials application process under the new framework will be more proportionate, streamlined, and flexible without compromising on safety, they say. For example, the integration of the regulatory and ethics reviews of clinical trial applications, which in pilots half the approval times for studies and cut the time from application to recruiting a first patient by 40 days, will be embedded into the new regulation. The MHRA will implement a timeline for completion of an application review within a maximum of 30 days in general, with a maximum 10 calendar days for a decision to be granted once the regulator has received any final information. The legislative changes will result in a regulatory framework that is future-proof as possible, responsive to different types of trials and innovative innovative designs and supportive of new ways of carrying out trials, such as decentralized trials, says the drug regulator. The framework will introduce a legal mandate to register the trial in a World Health Organization public register and a requirement to publish a summary of results within 12 months of the end of the trial. Anyway, it's very long-winded, but basically this was part of Rishi Sunak's and Jeremy Hunt's recent budget, and that was medical products will be fast-tracked and approved by the MHRA in a much quicker and more streamlined process. And this comes off the back of where we're getting our new vaccine factories that are popping up everywhere, like Moderna. I suspect that they will be some of the first products that come out of those factories will be through this new streamlined approach, James.
Yeah, now look, our politicians in the UK have been banking on the life sciences to be the next sort of financial centre of the world. Obviously, we've got a very big financial centre, but they're banking on the life sciences being the next big opportunity for the UK. And they've been doing, you know, they've been talking about this for the last two decades, and they put a big bet on it. And the reason why the UK is an attractive market for doing all of these clinical trials is because we have the NHS. In a lot of other countries, you have lots of different suppliers all capturing data and holding it in their silos. Whereas in the UK, we have the NHS, and in the large part, most people have not signed to say they do not want their data to be shared. So it's a very attractive market for big farmer. But what I would say is, why is the government investing so much money into drugs when actually it's investing absolutely nothing into encouraging in alternative lifestyles? I mean, it really, really does my head in round. If you drive around Wales, I'm sure it's the same everywhere across the UK. Literally on every other roundabout, what have you got? You've got a McDonald's, you've got a Burger King or whatever, Kentucky Fried Chicken. You know, I mean, there's one 100 metres from my son's school, which is just, I don't know how that got approved. You know, health does not come in a pill. It really doesn't. But it seems like that is the way the world is going. We are going down the road like the United States, where it seems that there's a pill to solve every problem that you have. Instead of actually tackling the cause, you tackle the symptoms. It is really, really scary. I do think we should fight back. And, you know, the report that I talked about from a private group, well, it remain private at the moment, but it's a group of experts, and it really does lay bare the MHRA. It's not a drug regulator. To call it a regulator is an absolute joke. Dame June Rain, the head of the MHRA, was right when she said it is an enabler. So this report is explosive. It's going to be published very, very soon. And I'm hoping that our MPs will take note. And all of this move to speed things up, we're already in a dire situation where, you know, the regulator hasn't picked up all the safety signals to do with AstraZeneca. And of course, the mRNA vaccines. And they're talking about making things easier and faster. Absolute joke. So this report really is, and this is why it is crunch time at lunchtime on the Freeman Report, because we're going to be talking about the emerging things coming up that we need to take action on.
Yeah, I mean, and then the MHRA is almost certainly an enabler of the pharmaceutical industry. I've got a comment here from your guest that's coming up in a minute, Dr. Claire Craig, who has done a lot of great work. She's part of HARP, a group of doctors and scientists who are looking into the COVID-19 pandemic. She says that's the first strategy to becoming an enabler of the pharmaceutical industry, but that's not what the public needs from them. The public needs them to be a watchdog. It doesn't mean that patients can't get drugs that they need, because doctors are able to prescribe things off license if the circumstances mean that that's a sensible thing to do. Hart has criticised and written to the MHRA regarding short and long-term safety, specifically concerning the COVID-19 vaccines, especially for children. And you touched on that earlier in this segment about ADHD. And I was just joking with Murray in the studio, though ADHD didn't exist when I was a kid. In fact, none of these, you know, Asperger's and autism and all these other things are definitely nothing to do with vaccines, we are being told. And I would have agreed and believed with that until I actually thought, you know what, after 2020, I'll go and have a look at the literature, particularly that by, is it Andrew Wakeham? It almost certainly, I would say, that the increase in vaccines and the number of vaccines and medications that are given to the very, very youngest, most vulnerable, most sensitive individuals in our society. Control group, yeah. It seems that there's been, as the number of vaccines increases, the number of these new conditions that Big Pharma probably are inventing or creating through their vaccination programs, and therefore are now looking at solutions in the form of a pill or a needle to the problems that they created in the first place. And you can see here that Dr. Claire Craig is calling out the need to rein in the MHRA.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, you know, Big Pharma, I mean, really what we're talking about is big corporations here. If you follow the structures up far enough and see who owns all these companies, well, they're the same companies that own McDonald's and all of the companies which are creating these health problems. The reason Darren mentioned the control group is because actually I'm waving a badge at him in front of my webcam here. The control group is a study, I think it's out of the States, where they've basically done a longitudinal study, and they followed kids from the age of naught all the way through up into adulthood. And what they've done is they've got two groups, one that's vaccinated with all the different vaccines you get these days, a lot more in the US, by the way, than in the UK. And they have a group which is not vaccinated. And what they've shown is all of these things like autism and like Darren was just saying, there is a link, apparently, between these vaccines and the increase in a lot of these new health issues. Now, Holly in the live chat says something important here. Holly says that basically they're actually now creating drugs to deal with the side effects of other drugs. And this is, yeah, very, 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 very spot on there, Holly, because my friend Chris, who was in my documentary, UKCV Family, A Letter to My MP, which was all about vaccine injuries, well, he has got 40% heart failure from the AstraZeneca vaccine. And lo and behold, what is he given to manage his heart condition? Drugs from AstraZeneca. It's a sick joke. It really is. It really is. Right, Darren, thank you very much. So you'll be joining me tomorrow for another big story of the day. Yep. But don't go anywhere, because we're going to be talking all about this after the break with my next guest.
You should hear what Alan Miller is talking about.
It seems to me that many people think that you can't really ever assess or evaluate anything scientifically, because on the one hand, there's things that are lied about or talked, and on the other hand, is it even possible to have an objective account of what's happened? I mean, how do you see that, first of all?
Well, I mean, you know, in a sense, yeah, that's what we have done instead, is rather than form a judgment about scientific fact, form a judgment about how, if you like, a discourse of science was developed, and the political framework of that, and the dimension of power and politics and of economic interests which have shaped the way in which what we call the COVID consensus emerged. So those are quite different things. But we do also say, you know, on the more kind of hotter topics like masking, vaccines, those kind of things, our interest is really around the way in which the economic and political frameworks produce the outcome that we saw, and how that is completely contrary to the scientific method.
Alan Miller and today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
This is today's News Talk Radio.
After all, we got the best damn staff on the planet. Yeah!
TNT.
Right. Obviously, before the break, what we were talking about is capture of research institutions, of universities and whatever by Big Pharma, and them basically directing and manipulating the research so that it shows exactly what they want to, so they can sell their drugs. Now, I mentioned ADHD, and that is because my next guest is an expert on this. He's a clinical psychologist, rather. Welcome to the show, Yakov Ofar.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm honored to appear on your show.
No. I'm honored to have you on the show. I mean, I came across you actually by Dr. Robert Malone, who had commented in his Substack on some research that you've done. So Yakov, first of all, if you can just give us a little bit about your background, explain what you do, and then tell us about the research that you've been doing into ADHD.
Of course. As you said, I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and I'm placed in Israel, and more specifically at the Technion. It's Israel premier institute for technology, but most of the time I'm doing research. I only work as a therapist one day a week, and the truth is that my primary field of research is not ADHD. It is actually depression and suicide, and especially in depression and suicide in the age of the digital era. And the reason that I'm located at the Technion is because, which is a technological institution, is because we are developing algorithms to detect suicide risk online. So this is what I do most of the time. But when my son, we have three children, my wife and I, and my firstborn son was, today he's 11 years old, but when he was only four, he was diagnosed with this alleged brain deficit, chronic brain deficit, that the only way to manage it, the leading and the key way to manage it is by stimulant medications, which are powerful psychiatric drugs like Ritalin and Adderall and alike. So even though I'm a clinical psychologist and I have a wide training that includes also ADHD, I decided that I need to learn about it a bit more just before I'm starting giving my own child, this young and curious and bright child, giving him such strong medications. And when I entered this field, I was amazed. I was really shocked by my findings. It's not most of my findings are not my own research. They're just the mainstream literature that I've read. It's not from the fringe of the internet. It's really from the heart of the scientific consensus. And what I discovered really amazed me. So I started writing about it. And when I first wrote about it in Hebrew, of course, for a local newspaper, a leading newspaper here in Israel, I wasn't prepared for what happened next. This short article that I wrote, it became one of the most read articles in that year. That was in 2019. I was approached from all the media here in Israel, and they always wanted to interview me. So for 2 weeks I went on interviews, and then I started receiving attacks from physicians and from scholars, and it was very harsh. And I'm not a politician. I'm not used to this battle. I'm a young scholar who tries to make science accessible to wide audiences. This is what I try to do, and I received also a formal complaint from the Ministry of Health So I was really worried. And that forced me to do my homework, to do the research, and eventually to publish the book that was published only very recently by World Scientific. It's a scientific book, but it's really accessible to parents. And the name of the book is ADHD is not an illness and Ritalin is not a cure. Essentially, this book is a comprehensive rebuttal of the what we call scientific consensus. So yes, this is in short my story with ADHD.
Fantastic. Well, the first thing I'm going to say is well done you for not kowtowing and keeping your head down. You've clearly gone on to write this book in the face of all of these attacks. And I believe, didn't they threaten to take your license off you?
So they did. It was a subtle threat, but I received a complaint, an official complaint from the Ministry of Health. And it was really scary. So this is actually what set my whole journey, because it forced me to write. I found myself writing a 10-page long answer, a fully referenced answer. And this answer became to be my first Hebrew my first scientific article in Hebrew. And then once this material got evolved and I started doing my own research, I started publishing also in English and writing this book. Remember, I used to write for academic journals. But here, James, this is really, really, really interesting that whenever I publish standard articles in my primary field, which is in psychopathology in the age of digital media, I publish in the top-notch journals, the most prestigious journals in the world. But when I try to write about ADHD and from my critical point of view, suddenly these journals blocked me. They don't let me to publish in the places where I should publish. So I found myself publishing in great journals, but they're not this is not really the best place to publish these studies and critical articles I published.
Fantastic. Well, listen, we're just going to go to the news headlines now, but don't go anywhere, Yakov, because afterwards I want to get more into the detail about your book and also about why you think it is. I'm sure that we all know, but I'd like to hear your view on why you think it is you were attacked and why these journals have stopped printing your articles. So stick with me, James Freeman, on TNT Radio.
TNTRadio.live.
The station, the first to broadcast.
Breaking news.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. In an effort to avoid civil war, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has bowed to public pressure and agreed to pause his plan to shake up the country's legal system. 18 main battle tanks from Germany have arrived in Ukraine, and Serbia has sounded the alarm over Britain's plan to arm Ukraine with ammunition made from depleted uranium, warning such a move could be seen as a declaration of nuclear war.
Don't miss a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download, keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
Right, Yakov. So we were talking about the before the break there, the instance of, you know, you published this article on ADHD. Then suddenly you find all these world leading journals suddenly not publishing your research anymore. And you got a threat from the Ministry from Health. Why do you think that is?
I'm trying not to be a conspiracy theorist. I'm really sticking to science, and so I will be very careful in my answer here. In my book, I only dedicate one chapter out of 12 to address this question that obviously it's a really good question, right? But let me be very careful here. I'm not sure what are the forces that are involved here. I assume that companies that have much to profit from selling the treatment of choice to ADHD, which are the stimulant medications, they have much to lose if the public understands that ADHD is not a real concept. It's not, I mean, children do have traits that what we call ADHD-like traits. They might be more active than others. They can be energetic. They can be easily distracted. But the chemical imbalance theory, it's a myth. No kid, at least we do not diagnose children with ADHD with objective measures. We do not look in their brain and say, oh, we find this hole in the brain, which is the ADHD. No, ADHD is like all other psychiatric concepts. It's a condition we diagnosed with observational measures. And that means that we look at on behaviors, and we humans, we decide if these behaviors, they are eligible to be called a disorder, a psychiatric, or in this case, a neuropsychiatric disorder. So I think they have much to lose if the public understands that ADHD does not meet the required criteria to give a person or a child a psychiatric diagnosis. And I think that they are terrified that the public will understand that these medications, they're not effective in the long term. And they have reverse efficacy. That means that if you take them if a child takes these medications for a while, then in the long term, it is expected that the symptoms will only increase. And there's a simple explanation to that, and maybe we'll get into that later. And of course, these medications have tremendous amount of side effects and really serious adverse outcomes. But this is also something that we can get into later in the interview.
Yeah, so somebody in the chat, is actually Jim from the UK, says that the founding father who kind of came up with the ADHD has announced months before he died that it is actually a fictitious disorder. I'm not an expert in this area. Is that your understanding of this?
Yes, let me give you the exact quote. It will take me just a second. I'll find it. It's really beautiful. The person who is sometimes called the father of ADHD is Dr. Keith Connors. We diagnose ADHD using his ADHD scales. And I think in about 2012, maybe later, something like that, 2000, maybe in 2014, he was invited to be a keynote speaker in an ADHD experts conference. And he said, and this is the quote, I bring it by the journalist who brought this quote is Alan Schwartz, who also wrote a book, a wonderful book about ADHD. And this, so here is the quote. The numbers of ADHD, right? The numbers make it look like an epidemic. Well, it's not. It's preposterous. This is a concussion to justify the giving out of medication at unprecedented and unjustifiable levels. So this is his words, not mine. I became a known ADHD critic, but ADHD, Keith Connors, Dr. Keith Connors, God rest his soul. He's from the heart of the mainstream. He's the founder, one of the founders of the concept that is called ADHD, and he understood already about 10 years ago that something is wrong here. Something is off.
Wow. Well, Jim in the chat, well done you for picking up that. We think we've got an expert in the chat here. Yakov, let's talk about these drugs, Ritalin and did you say Adderall? What are they? What do they do? And, you know, are these just minor drugs or, you know, what kind of effect do they have in the long term in terms of side effects and other negative effects?
So we'll start with the fact that these drugs they belong to a cluster of psychoactive drugs that are called stimulant drugs, and in a way their name is is confusing because you take a child and you give him a stimulant, but the stimulant makes him more what is the word? More quiet or more the drug actually depresses the child. It's really hard to think about it because it's something, in my opinion, it's a terrible thing that we are doing to children. But so these stimulant drugs, they work in a very similar way to other illicit drugs like cocaine. And so if you take them for several times, you might feel a very that you have powers that you didn't have before, that you can suddenly concentrate for hours and do things that you couldn't do before. But if you take them for a long time, and remember that the way that ADHD is conceptualized is that it's a chronic, it's a lifelong disorder. So you have to take these medications every day. And the scientific consensus representatives, they insist that this is not a school medication. It's a medication that you need to take throughout your life. Otherwise, people will reveal the simple truth that these are just the cognitive enhancers that are prescribed to children to be better at school. But so they tell you, the representatives of the consensus, they tell you that this is a drug that the child has to take in order to prevent all kinds of dangers, including getting infected by COVID. This is a real research that was published in the Journal of Attention Disorders. And this research claimed that children and adults who have ADHD, they should take stimulant medications to prevent being infected or to reduce the risk of being infected and to being affected by COVID-19. This is ridiculous, right? So these stimulant drugs, what they do, if you take them for long periods, they you're putting yourself at a great risk to numerous adverse outcomes. It's starting from the what they call the non-serious adverse outcomes, which are really, really serious. It includes tics and depression and nightmares and sleep difficulties, all a range of side effects, of unwanted side effects.
So you talked about this negative kind of effect that if people take it for a long time, they actually is that because of the tolerance? So over time, you become tolerant to the positive effects of it, so they have less of an effect. But actually, all drugs have got side effects, and obviously, these are quite powerful drugs. Is that how the mechanism works?
So it will be hard for me to go into the mechanism here, but you are right that all medications have side effects, but we are talking about medications that are they cross the blood-brain barrier. So they impact our brain. They impact who we are. And like all other drugs that cross the blood-brain barrier, they trigger a compensatory mechanism, because the brain it identifies these drugs as neurotoxins. And what it does in order to survive, to cope with this attack from this external substance that is put into the brain. The brain, what it does over time, it starts demolishing or destroying cells that should receive the dopamine. Once you try to stop the medication, then you see these withdrawal symptoms, which they know it by the rebound effect. But what is the rebound effect? The rebound effect is a bad sign. It's a bad sign that your child is starting to develop dependency. So over time, if you take these medications, over time you put yourself in a great risk, not only for dependency but also for brain damages. And I really hate scaring people. I don't like this discourse. But in this case, this is what the mainstream literature suggests. About 1%. This is, and 1% is a lot, because think about it. So many children are diagnosed with ADHD, and most of them will receive this treatment of choice. So about 1% are expected to develop a severe adverse outcome. And I guess the most known outcome, also acknowledged by proponents of the disorder, is the cardiovascular outcomes. So these stimulants they put a burden on our cardiovascular system, and over time they can trigger cardiovascular deficits.
Well, listen, Yakov, thank you so much for explaining all that. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's really worrying to me that we're giving powerful drugs like this to children in the first place, but particularly after what you've explained, which is over the long term, actually, they don't have positive effects. And obviously, there's lots of negative effects. So thank you very much, Yakov. I hope you'll come back on the show again soon. Have a great day. Right, okay, we're going to take a quick break. Thank you, Yakov. So we're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, I will have the amazing Claire Craig from Heart Group. So stick with me, James Freeman, on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Previously, I told you about President Biden's nominee to head the Federal Aviation Administration, Philip Washington, a military veteran who is CEO of Denver International Airport. Now, after his Senate hearing some 3 weeks ago, I let you hear how, based on his inability to answer one question after another on vital issues, there was no way this man should be confirmed to the position. Remember this?
What airspace requires an ADS-B transponder? Quickly, please.
Thank you for the question, Senator. Not sure I can answer that question right now.
That's okay. We'll just keep going. So what are the six types of special use airspace that protect this national security that appear on FAA charts? Quickly, please.
Sorry, Senator, I cannot answer that question.
Can you tell me what causes an aircraft to spin or to stall?
Again, Senator, I'm not a pilot.
Thank goodness Washington has withdrawn his nomination after it became evident that he would not get voted out of committee for a full vote on the Senate floor. Washington is black, and in this administration, that's probably why he was nominated. Wokeness can be dangerous. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
In regional and rural areas of our great country, the sun brings a heavy toll. Skin cancer hits us hard. And if you've spent a lot of time out under the sun, your risk is high. Melanoma is the deadliest skin cancer, but it's curable if you get it early. Monthly skin checks are a must. If a spot, mole or freckle, deadliest skin cancer, but it's curable if you get it early. Monthly skin checks are a must. If a spot, mole or freckle doesn't look or feel right, don't wait. To find out more, visit melanomapatients.org.au.
The Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, it certainly is the Freeman Report, and I am James Freeman. And I am delighted to welcome back to the Freeman Report the amazing Dr. Claire Craig. Hello, Claire.
Hello, James. Thanks for having me on again.
No, thank you for coming back. We didn't put you off the first time. And obviously, the last time you were on, we talked all about midazolam and what was going on there. And I think that was a fantastic, enlightening interview that you gave there. Now, what I want to talk about today is the MHRA, because it seems that our regulator has stopped being a regulator and become an enabler, hasn't it?
Well, indeed. And Dame June Rain, who is the chief executive of the MHRA, which is a slightly funny title for a regulatory body. But anyway, she herself announced that that's what they were doing. She said they were changing from being a watchdog to becoming an enabler. Now, of course, there's not much point having a regulator if they think their role is to enable the pharmaceutical industry. We need them there as a watchdog.
We certainly do. And another thing I said at the top of the hour in my introduction was that she also said that the MHRA building is full of policemen that hold up drugs coming onto the market, which just seems preposterous, really, because they're not there to hold up. What they're actually doing is making sure that drugs are safe when they come on the market. So I think, you know, these are not our words. These are the chief executive of the MHRA herself, Dame Rain. Now, tell us, Claire, about some of the failures that we know about at the MHRA.
So we've actually just about to publish a report, a group of us, on the really quite multitude of failings that the MHRA have had over the last few years. And the people writing the report come from all sorts of different areas of safety regulation, where it seems that it's done quite differently in other domains to the way it's done by the MHRA. And the kinds of things that we have concerns about are, I think if we're being very, very generous and we say, look, this was an unprecedented situation, then you might want to have different rules for having an emergency use approval. And then I think it's acceptable to have different standards for different situations. But what we found was that the approval that was done as an emergency never was followed by careful studies to fill in all the gaps that had been skipped in order to get that emergency approval. So, yes, okay, we might be able to make things simpler and speed things up, but only if we're then going to be very, very careful thereafter. And that includes, following up those first people who would vaccinated as if they were then a very large scale trial, and being absolutely certain that we do understand the safety implications. But what we've had happen instead is that the pharmaceutical company's words have been taken as the truth, and anything that they've submitted in evidence doesn't seem to have been questioned or checked in any way. It's just been accepted as what they've said must be true. And of course, with the best will in the world, they're not unbiased, and we shouldn't be just taking their word for these things.
Yeah, I mean, I think, in any other industry, you wouldn't have the businesses that are going to benefit from whatever it is that's being regulated actually marking their own homework. But that is what goes on in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, the other thing that there's lots of things in the report that it highlights. One of the interesting things is the MHRA doesn't seem to have a safety tolerance for the mRNA jabs, does it? So what I mean by that is in other industries, say like in the airplane industry, they would say that you would have so many hours of flying and for one crash. So that might be, I don't know, I'll make the numbers up. It might be a million hours of flying and you get one crash. Any more than that, and we know something's wrong. Now you'd think that they would do the same, because, if they're going to say it's safe and effective, which is what the mantra has been, surely they need to define what safe means, don't they, Claire?
Well, absolutely. So what we do with drug safety is to compare new drugs with how old drugs have performed. And, that is a method of doing it. Really what you want to do is approach it from lots of different angles. And the key data that you need is to see whether a particular condition has become more common as a consequence of that drug being used. But when they're doing this comparison, there seems to always be this ready-made excuse that because everybody's attention was on COVID, and because COVID vaccines, at least in the UK, were issued at a much higher rate than other vaccines, well, of course, we're going to see lots of reports about them. And there didn't seem to be any kind of threshold at which you'd say, actually, this is something to be concerned about. Everything was readily dismissed. And, what you would hope to see is that there was some kind of threshold for every condition, at which point you would say, we're going to pause and investigate further. It doesn't mean that you need to have a great big panic, and it doesn't mean that people need to think it's unsafe when you're doing that. But in many ways, that I think people would have found that reassuring to know that things, would be paused and investigated whenever there was a concern. But instead, because of the huge political pressure, the idea of a pause was never on the table. And so didn't seem to be any problem that would have caused anything to slow down or halt. And we had a situation where in Denmark, the AstraZeneca vaccine was pulled after only 150,000 doses had been given. And we were into the millions at that point in this country. And there are people who died because of that vaccine, who, if they had been Danish, would not have been given it. And, that's really just unforgivable. And there's no reason why, when we were ahead of the game, we should have been so slow to notice the problems.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of where I was taking the conversation, because as well as not saying what it means by safe, i.e., you know, we'll accept maybe one death for every 10 million people or whatever it is that they, you know, they did not define what safe means. They just said it's safe. But that has real world consequences, because as you said, you know, the AstraZeneca vaccine, that went on, they kept on delivering that program for months and months after after Denmark and I think about six or seven other countries withdrew AstraZeneca from the market. We don't know exactly when the UK government decided that actually it better take it off the market, because it did it quietly without any fanfare, no big announcement. But what we do know from yellow card reports and also coroner's reports, like you said, Claire, that people died and were injured as a result. Now, that leads us on to the yellow card system, because there's some interesting FOIs that are contained within this report, aren't there, that show the lack of processes in the MHRA. Tell us a little bit about that, Claire.
Well, what we sometimes found with these FOIs is that the MHRA would say, would give us very odd answers. They said for one of them, we have this information, but we're not going to give it to you. And they didn't seem to have they didn't seem to have their finger on the pulse about what they did and didn't know. They've not been clear about what they do and don't know and what numbers they have. And in terms of process, I think there's a specific FOI you're thinking about that I can't recall. Why didn't you?
Yeah, well, there was one, wasn't it, where, there's several. One of them actually asked the MHRA if it had an internal process for investigating yellow card reports. They came back and basically it was clear that they haven't got an internal process. So if that's the case, are they actually investigating any of the yellow cards? And if they are, then how are they accumulating the data to then suggest whether it's safe or not, if you haven't got an internal process? The other one that was really interesting, and I think that was the one you were touching on there, Claire, was the one, wasn't it, whereby I think the FI asked how many people were on the database that potentially, that died, that actually was due to you know, the vaccines, and they came back with a response, wasn't it, that it would be too expensive to investigate, which suggests that they haven't been collating the data and they don't analyze the data, because if they had it, why would it be expensive to investigate? They would just simply be able to turn the laptop on and look at the database and see that. So there's lots of, I think, failings that we're uncovering. Tell us a little bit about some of the other big issues with the MHRA, Claire.
Okay, so one of the major problems seems to be a complete disconnect between the MHRA and reports of people dying. So you mentioned those coroner's reports, but there doesn't seem to be a system whereby coroners, when they've got concern about something that's caused an unnatural death, they can write a special report to highlight it to particular people. And they might send their report to those people, but there isn't any sort of automatic connection between the coroner and the MHRA so that the MHRA get those reports. So they haven't been seeing them. And they don't seem to be connected through to the ONS or any kind of other death certificate reporting so that they see that data and that information. And, you know, furthermore, I'm a pathologist. Obviously, I'm interested in postmortems. And we postmortems have not been done in the way that they could have been done. You know, there hasn't been a sort of active intention to make sure we've understood all of this. And where they have been carried out, again, the MHRA don't seem to be on top of that information, which is really, really concerning, because surely that's, you know, the tip of the iceberg. That's really, if you don't have a grip on the data on something causing death, then you really have not got a grip on the situation as a regulator at all.
Yeah, and the other big thing, and I think this is actually real criminal stuff, which the UK government is responsible for as well, because, of course, the Medicines Agency used to be the European Medicines Agency, and we would put, we would contribute towards that. And I think the MHRA in the UK used to look at around 10% of drugs. And of course, after Brexit, that went up to 100%. And what did the UK government do? They cut the staffing, didn't they? And not only that, but we've now learned, and I forget the exact figure, but it's, I think it's above 20%. They've got 20% or around that figure of vacancies now as well. So their work has increased. The UK government has cut the number of staff they've got, and they can't even fill those staff. How are they supposed to regulate the UK drugs market if they haven't even got the staff, Claire?
Well, I mean, the thing about that is that, you know, we lived in a world where openness is really the future, and everybody knew that this was a situation, and everybody knew that this was an unprecedented situation. They were being asked to assess, you know, massive trials in quick succession to make these approvals. The answer to that is to be honest and say, look, we don't have the capacity here to do this in the most thorough way possible. So we are going to share all of this. We're going to have as many eyes on this as we possibly can. And then, you know, everybody would have been all over it. And that really is something that they could have done to have made, you know, to have just been a bit more honest instead of pretending that they had absolute certainty it was safe when they could not have done.
Well, listen, Claire, thank you so much for coming on the show. What I'd like to do is get you and some of the other authors back on the show for a whole hour, I think, when the report is actually published, because this report is going to be dynamite. Thank you very much, Claire. I look forward to you coming back on the show again soon. Don't go anywhere. Stick with TNT Radio.